Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by Quip. We have a lot of things to talk about today. The Democrats have unveiled two articles of impeachment. They went narrow. There's no impeachment for bribery or no reference to the Mueller investigation. Is that a smart move? Within minutes of that, they also announced that they have reached a deal with the White House on this revised trade deal with Canada and Mexico, which is going to be a big win for the Trump White House. Not obviously a win as well for Nancy Pelosi, but a lot of questions about the cognitive dissonance there. And of course, we have the ongoing spin wars about the IG report, including the extraordinary behavior of the Attorney General and his handpicked prosecutor, John Durham. But I want to start off by talking about the President of the United States lashing out at his FBI director, and we are joined once again by David Preece, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare. Good to have you back, Dave.
It's good to be back. It's a really interesting day with these stories intersecting. Obviously, the impeachment articles are huge, but you've got other stories which otherwise would be dominating the news cycle all day.
Well, that seems to happen all the time, you know, in Trump time. You know, these stories, each one of these stories would dominate the news for weeks, and you wonder whether they'll survive the news cycle. So I am fascinated by this whole Christopher Wray question, and we won't spend a huge amount of time on it. But I was debating whether or not I wanted to give three cheers to Christopher Wray or two cheers. He gave this extraordinary interview to ABC News saying there was no indication that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election. And he really pushed back on the conspiracy theories that have been advanced by Trump world and by Donald Trump himself. He said, we have no information that indicates that Ukraine interfered with the election. Well, look, there's all kinds of people saying all kinds of things out there. Well, yes. I think it's important for the American people to be thoughtful consumers of information and to think about the sources of it, and to think about the support and predication for what they hear. In other words, don't listen to Sean Hannity. Don't listen to the Devin Nunes's of the world. And then he went on to basically cite the IG report that said that there was sufficient predicate to begin the Russia investigation, that there was no signs of bias. He acknowledged that there was a lot of messy stuff involving the FISA warrant, and he said that they were going to take multiple steps. I think he announced that they would take 40 different corrective measures. None of that was enough. So the President of the United States lashes out at his own FBI director. Interestingly enough, Jonathan Swan then went out and he asked people, so is the president thinking of firing the FBI director since he's done that before? And the consensus seems to be that Trump would love to fire Christopher Wray, but he doesn't want to go through what he went through after he fired Jim Comey. So, David, I guess the question that I have is that, you know, Christopher Wray is standing up for his agency, is pushing back against the spin. The contrast between him and Bill Barr could not be more dramatic. On the other hand, it does occur to me that, you know, as opposed to the three cheers, you know, when he took the job, he had to know who Donald Trump was. So give me your take of this moment that we're at here.
Let me hit you back first, yeah. Charlie. What would he have said or done that would have gotten him to that third cheer, given that he took the job in the first place?
Yeah, see, I don't
know.
Is
there anything he could have done that would have moved you to a solid three cheers?
Maybe if he would have stood up for his the men and women in his agency earlier and more forcefully.
Okay, but as of the statement itself, that was a pretty solid statement. That is,
it was gutsy.
Chris Wray knew that he's in a narrow channel, which is he can't go full throated against the president twisting this or any other report because he's, in a sense, working for the president. On the other hand, he can't go along with what the president says because the president is not telling the truth. He's not even characterizing the report accurately. In that, I think Wray did a very good job of saying what needed to be said. He acknowledged this report highlights things that are serious and need to be addressed, and I will address them. And then he said, you know, it made clear that the origins of the investigation were you know, correctly predicated and everything else. Basically, that's not hard to do objectively. That is to characterize the clear conclusions of this report. All he had to do is describe what Horowitz himself wrote. But in this environment, you know, telling the truth to the emperor is hard. Ray did it. Ray did it well. Will he be fired? Almost everything in me, Charlie, says no. Firing a second FBI director who, again, people forgot because of what happened with Jim Comey. But this is exactly why Congress instituted a 10-year term for the FBI director, to protect them, insulate them somewhat from politics, even if the president still can fire the FBI director. The norm setting, the expectation was to be that the FBI director would be insulated from these kinds of things. So it would be difficult for him to do so politically. That said, how many times have you and I been on this podcast where we've talked about something that would be difficult for Trump to do politically, and he's just done it because he feels like it?
Well, okay, and going back to the two cheers, three cheers, I think you make a very, very compelling point. And actually, this is why I did not write a piece about just the two cheers, because objectively speaking, at this moment, the alternative to Christopher Wray would be worse. We know that it would be clearly worse, because at this point, whoever took that job would do so knowing everything, you know, that Donald Trump has done, would have read the Mueller report, would have understood the obstruction of justice, would have watched the president lying and dismantle the reputation of the FBI, defy the intelligence agencies. So whoever would take the job now, I think, would be objectively worse than Christopher Wray. So we have to be extremely grateful that he is in that position. And I agree with you, by the way, that especially given the fact that impeachment is hanging over his head, it's unlikely that he would fire Christopher Wray. But here's the thing, and as you point out, once impeachment is over and he is acquitted by the Senate, what stops him? Stops him from doing it? And here's another question: which Republican member of the Senate would stand up and push back on him at this point?
Yeah, I'd like to think they're there, but as we've talked about on other cases, I'm not sure who's there because of the rot that we've seen within the legislature in terms of standing up for the rule of law. So I'm not confident of that. I think the more interesting side is you look at all the people in the hearings in the last few weeks who have been, in a sense, auditioning. If a spot for FBI director comes up, you've got everybody from, you know, Jim Jordan to Matt Gaetz to everybody putting out there, I'm going to top you, whoever spoke before me, I'm going to top you in terms of my full-throated defense of the president, my rejection of facts, my spinning of conspiracy theories, my parroting of Russian disinformation, just so I can get that attention from the president. To me, that's been the Republican side of these hearings so far, has been virtual casting call for Trump for his various positions that may open up. In terms of Wray, there is a lot of support for Chris Wray on the Hill. And that does matter, because to the extent that people are going to talk to Donald Trump about something and put themselves out there and say, Mr. President, I'm with you on this, 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 and this, but this is too far. The one we've seen on that was Syria and the Kurds, when you saw a lot of pushback from Republicans. This could be another one if it's about Chris Wray basically serving your agenda, Mr. President. He's not like Jim Comey. He's doing what you want him to do. That's the spin they'd put on it. But there's a lot of people who think highly of Wray, and I think he would have people speaking up on his behalf, unlike some of these other cases we've seen.
Well, I hope you are right here. Matthew Miller, who's a former spokesman for the DOJ, had an interesting tweet earlier this morning. He said, for people who say ignore the tweets, referring to Donald Trump's tweet about Wray, said, this is very much the stakes of impeachment. Whether Trump's three-year campaign to turn every instrument of government into his personal protection squad succeeds. And I think he's right here. I mean, there are not many. When you see what Bill Barr is prepared to do, and you see the people that he is empowering, you do see how far he's going. And by the way, Karen Tumulty from The Washington Post tweeted, just remember, you heard it here first, FBI Director Jeanine Pirro. I upped that one. I said Seb Gorka, FBI Director. Seb.
Dr. Seb Gorka, Charlie.
Okay, so let's talk about this IG report, long awaited. It does seem that both sides are seizing on things. The Trump supporters are seizing on the FISA irregularities, which are seem to be serious, but don't go to the heart of the investigation. And most everybody else is pointing out that most of the conspiracy theories the Trump world had advanced, Spygate, all of that, the bias, the fix, all of that has been completely exploded. So your take on balance, what is your what's your lead on your story from the Inspector General report?
I have no interest in spinning this. I have an interest in just describing what it says. And it does have several messages, which I still don't think are too complex for the American public to digest. I don't think we have to get it down to one bullet point. Part of it is that there were irregularities in the FISA process that did affect, I think, in particular, Carter Page. And that is something that needs addressing. FISA is a very strong tool of the government. It has robust oversight for a very good reason. And if there are problems in that, they need to be addressed. Kudos to Chris Wray for saying that and saying, yes, we need to deal with the issues that were there. That does not equate to a problem with the entire FBI investigation that came to them of Russian interference and information warfare in the election. That clearly was properly predicated. That clearly did not rely on the Steele dossier, two words I expect never to hear again at this point, because that emerged and came to the FBI's attention after the other information which led to the investigation. And Horowitz was meticulous in going after information, interviewing people, going through documents. It's very clear that he did his homework. There was a parallel there in my mind to the Mueller report, in that it was clear that this was not put out there casually. This was not something he rushed through. This was something that he made sure he could say definitively this, this, and this. Now, there was a difference with the Mueller report. The Mueller report was very, it seemed like Mueller and the other drafters of the report were very cognizant of the fact that they could not speculate, that they had to merely present facts as they uncovered them. Whereas the Horowitz report mixes fact and some reasonable speculation and inference. Okay, that makes sense. It is an inspector general report, not a special counsel report to the deputy attorney general. But I think it did satisfy anybody who was still wondering, you know, is there really something behind all of these claims of conspiracy and deep state and a coup within the government? And that was what this whole thing was about. If anybody was still on the fence about that and can read and think, this puts those issues to rest.
Yeah, there's a big if there, though. So your colleague Benjamin Wittes, I think very helpfully comes up with sort of a summary of all of the legends and narratives, counter narratives from Trump world, you know, that this whole thing was a malicious witch hunt, that the president repeatedly accused FBI officials of treason, of plotting a coup.
Yep.
Hello. And then, of course, the obsession with the text from Peter Strzok and Lisa Page about the insurance policy, all of those texts. Mm-hmm. The attorney general who warned darkly of FBI spying on the Trump campaign. A veritable industry arose suggesting that the investigation began earlier than the FBI acknowledged. Mm-hmm. An industry the attorney general personally helped cultivate. The president suggested his wires had been tapped, even as Devin Nunes insisted the FBI was engaged in illegal surveillance of Carter Page. And we were assured of a scandal related to the FBI's use of confidential informants, just as we were assured the entire investigation was predicated on the dossier of Christopher Steele. And now we know none of that was true, and except if you watch Sean Hannity or you read The Federalist, I suppose.
If the president did not have the sense of shame to prevent him in the first place from casting aspersions on so many people that were involved in protecting the country's national security. And not all of them are perfect people. Many of them have admitted personal mistakes. But when you take such a wide brush to use the word treason against people, and then something like this comes out that is definitive in saying none of that happened, none of what you thought was out there that could have led to treason was there. I think Jim Baker, former FBI general counsel, said it right on television yesterday. He just said the president owes me an apology. And I think if he didn't have the shame to withhold on those comments when he made them, which clearly he didn't, he certainly should have the respect for the process and the respect for these people to now say, I was wrong. You did not do all those things I accused you of. Sorry. Of course, we won't hear that, which is part of the problem, but that is what a normal human being in this case would do if they had made those earlier horrific mistakes. And I just don't expect to see that happen.
Well, what is your take on the behavior by Attorney General Bill Barr and by John Dunham, who is his handpicked prosecutor? Let's start with Barr, the attorney general who's been floating these things out, traveling around the world with Dunham, trying to dig up, you know, this counter narrative on the conspiracy. The attorney general issues a statement essentially arguing with and denying the findings of his own inspector general report. I'm pretty sure that that's never happened before, that an inspector general says that the department had not engaged in misconduct, and the head of the department says, yes, I still think they did.
And it's possible that heads of departments have thought that before. Yeah. Usually it goes the other way, Charlie.
Yeah, right.
Usually
right.
The inspectors general are notorious for digging into every decision made at every stage of every process related to the thing they were charged with investigating. When you do that, because we are all fallible human beings, you will find errors. You will find mistakes. I have yet to see an IG report in my time in government and since that did not find mistakes, things that probably should not have happened but did and need to be remedied in the future. Okay, that's fine. Normally, you have the head of an agency saying, yes, 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 all that's true, but on the big issue, we did okay.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have the opposite. You have the IG coming out saying, here are some small issues, not small, I shouldn't say that. Here are some significant issues, but not related to the original purpose of the investigation in terms of finding what led to the FBI investigation. And instead, you have the head of the department coming out and saying, you know what, I don't agree with this. This isn't right. Now, if this was the first encounter we had with Bill Barr as attorney general, we might be inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt for a moment, at least to explain, what do you possibly know that you did not give your inspector general access to so that he could not include it in his report? Because that's really the only explanation, unless there's a huge matter of interpretation here, and there really isn't. On the facts that Horowitz found, there is no interpretation of those facts that leads to an opposite conclusion on the big questions. But Bill Barr doesn't have that credibility. He proved with the Mueller report release and the aftermath of that, and in subsequent cases, that he is not a good faith actor for either the institution of the Department of Justice or for the principle of rule of law. That is a problem because anything he says is suspect, which can only corrode the morale of the DOJ more.
Bill Barr continues to be sort of mind-boggling to the extent that he's willing to go to run cover for Donald Trump. And I think that the contrast between Christopher Wray and Bill Barr is really, you know, stark this morning. That you have Christopher Wray, who is trying to defend the integrity of the FBI, whereas Bill Barr's concern is to protect the president and to do everything possible. I think everybody was kind of blown away by the statement by John Durham, who is considered to be a respected independent prosecutor who is still investigating, doing a criminal investigation. And he did something that, as far as I can tell, is completely unprecedented and a violation of most Department of Justice protocols, issuing a statement in the midst of his investigation saying he disagreed with the inspector general. So clearly, you get the sense that the word came from the White House to Bill Barr, you have to spin this, you have to continue to run cover, you know, to cover for me, and you need to get that Durham guy to also say something. What does it tell you, the fact that Durham did something that prosecutors are not supposed to do, which is comment on a pending investigation?
Right. I'm going to defer to the legal experts on this, the people who understand these processes because they've lived in them and worked them. I mean, I got to know FBI really well when I was briefing Director Mueller for a year as a CIA officer, but I was not of the prosecutor's offices. Okay. I didn't work on those.
Okay.
The people who have, I have seen them comment with near unanimity that this is either unprecedented, a word some of them have used, or extremely unusual and improper. Well, if your fallback is extremely unusual and improper, you've still got a problem. I don't understand his motive for doing this. It does cast a lot of suspicion on whatever comes out of his investigation now, because there is no reasonable interpretation, again, of what Horowitz did that would lead somebody to release this statement in the middle of his own investigation. That doesn't have a corrupt motive or something else going on that is yet unclear to us. I think that if he would have stayed silent and if he would have differed on a few minor points or maybe had some different information sources here or there that shed a little bit of light on this aspect or that aspect of the investigation, that's fine. That makes sense. They have slightly different missions. But to come out now and say this puts a huge shadow over anything he comes out with at the end.
Both politically and legally, because, you know, if he does bring criminal charges, he will have a higher burden of proof. And obviously, his behavior and the information in the IG report is going to undercut whatever case he brings. Okay, let's switch gears, because the big story of the day, of course, is the Democrats unveil finally the two articles of impeachment. And apparently, they are dead set on voting on them on the floor within the next week. So let's talk about and your reaction to their decision to go narrow, just the two, not bribery, not dealing with the obstruction in the Mueller report. We'll do that right after a word from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip, makers of the Quip electric toothbrush. This is something I actually have. I've been using it for months now, and they want you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care is simply this. If you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. But Quip makes that simple. Starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You never run out. You don't have to run to the store. It comes right to you. Join more than 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S, right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Let me spell that out. GETQUIP.com/sykes. Quip, the good habits company. We're back with David Priest from Lawfare Blog. Okay, so David, you've had a chance to look at these impeachment articles. You've written a whole book on removing the president. Give me your take.
The impeachment articles as drafted, we have to remember they're subject to markup, so there will be some minor changes going forward. But the articles as drafted clearly reflect the House leadership's decision to go narrow, to focus on the most egregious instances of presidential misbehavior, and to make a strategic choice about voting that I'll get to in a moment. But first, on why they went narrow. The articles are helpfully titled for us. One of them is on abuse of power, and one of them is on obstruction of Congress. The abuse of power article actually includes most, if not all, of the elements that have been laid out in some analysis of the use of bribery in the Constitution to impeach the president. They don't do an article of bribery, however. It is still within the rubric of high crimes and misdemeanors, within that abuse of power. And that abuse of power makes sense. It builds on history. You had an abuse of power article against Richard Nixon that was very strong. The Andrew Johnson articles of impeachment way back in the 1860s had elements of abuse of power. So there's a very strong foundation to call it abuse of power. And what they do in just a few pages in the article of impeachment on abuse of power is lay out the evidentiary results of what was discovered in the Ukraine affair and giving just enough direct evidence of what happened to say here is the strongest case that the president abused his power and violated his oath. Then in the second article, they move to obstructing Congress. And what's interesting there is they focus on the officials and the agencies and offices of those officials who have failed to comply with subpoenas. They're not talking here about Don McGahn, who is going through a judicial process of does he have to appear or not. For these officials, and they cite by name some of these officials, such as Mick Mulvaney, such as Ulrich Breckbull, such as Robert Blair, people who were asked to appear and simply defied the subpoenas for testimony. They didn't exert a privilege. They didn't go to court and make the case why they couldn't show up. They simply refused to show up at all. In that, the article of impeachment clearly parallels one of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. One of the articles against Nixon said that Nixon had failed without lawful cause or excuse to produce papers and things as directed by duly authorized subpoenas. Very similar in language and tone to this obstruction of Congress article. I found a couple of things interesting that were inside here, that inside these articles, which are focused on the Ukraine matter, you do have some interesting language, almost like an homage to the Mueller report, when they say these actions were consistent with President Trump's previous efforts to undermine United States government investigations into foreign interference in United States elections. So they chose not to include an obstruction of justice article based on, for example, the president telling Don McGahn, the White House counsel, to create a false document at the White House. That is clearly obstruction of justice. That is actually hitting a criminal bar if you were to look to make a crime against the president charge. And yet they chose not to include it, but they still want to remind representatives, this is a pattern of behavior. This is consistent with what we found from the Mueller report, and we can't leave that aside. So in summary, I think these articles did what they're meant to do, which is present a clear, compelling case for why the president has violated his oath and committed high crimes and misdemeanors. I do think that's there. They decided strategically not to include other things that were a little bit harder to argue. I tend to think that's a strategic mistake, because if you are a moderate Democrat choosing whether to vote on these, or let's say, if there's one left, a moderate non-cultist Republican, you might want to say this behavior, as alleged in one of these articles, is so egregious that I have to vote for it. But you want to be able to say to your constituents and perhaps to the president, but I'm not out to get you, and that's why I'm not voting against these other articles.
Right, voting for them.
When you have only two core articles, you don't give representatives a lot of choice to, in a sense, cover themselves by voting against a slightly less strong article. There are reasons for that, too, but I think that is a strategic mistake by the House leadership.
Yeah, but remind me, during the impeachment of Richard Nixon, there were some articles that were drawn up that were not approved by the Judiciary
Correct.
Committee. So there was that kind of a menu. You can vote for yep. this, but you don't have to vote for this. Now, your colleague Susan Hennessy wrote a very strong piece on Lawfare, saying that it would be a really egregious mistake, a terrible blunder for them not to include a specific charge from the Mueller report. And she really honed in on the part of the report that found that the president had told his counsel to try to fire Bob Mueller. He got out, and then he told McGahn to lie about it, threatened to fire him if he did not lie about it. And in the Mueller report, that would clearly meet a criminal threshold, a threshold of criminal activity. There was clearly corrupt intent. It would have been one of the strongest specific elements from the Mueller report. But they obviously, as you point out, made the strategic mistake, the strategic decision not to include that sort of thing.
Yeah, and they could have included it in a way that they couldn't have included easily some other issues that people are claiming they should. Let me break that apart for you. On the emoluments clause, let's say, the president, I think, clearly violating the spirit, probably the letter of the emoluments clause. But Congress has had neither a report from a special investigator or special counsel,
correct,
nor material from its own hearings to build up the full evidentiary basis to say, we looked into it, we did our homework, we got all the information we could, therefore we drafted this article. They just don't have that material. This case, they actually do have the material. They have it from the Mueller report. And you can say that Robert Mueller declined to indict the president because of the Office of Legal Counsel memo saying that that cannot happen. That's fine. But that does not mean that the House cannot impeach. In fact, Mueller put in the report itself, there are other remedies cited by the Office of Legal Counsel why you do not have to be able to indict a sitting president. And one of those is the impeachment process. So that record was there. And you even had Mueller talking about it when he was called upon to testify. Now, that was not robust testimony. the Mueller testimony in person just repeated most of what was in the report. But you do at least have that to hang on if you wanted to include an article on obstruction of justice. I think it is a mistake not to include that, if not for the reason I mentioned earlier, which is you give representatives a choice. Well, maybe I won't vote for this one, but I'll vote for these others. But I think also because of the precedent it sets. Essentially, by not putting an article of impeachment on that when you are clearly putting forward other articles, you are essentially saying to future generations, this kind of behavior, as ugly as it is, we did not deem worthy of even trying to pass through the Judiciary Committee an article of impeachment, much less through the whole House, much less to convict him and remove him on. We did not even want to have the Judiciary Committee voting on whether creating a false document to cover up was impeachable. And I think that's the problem, because we are right now looking back at the Clinton, the Nixon, even the Andrew Johnson impeachments for precedent. Future generations look back to this impeachment process for precedent, and they're going to see, well, they did not try to put an article of impeachment against the president on this very serious charge.
So this is a political question now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how I feel about it. I go back and forth. It's mainly tactical. It felt very strange to watch the Democrats unveil their articles of impeachment against the president and then immediately turn around and hand the president this significant policy win by coming up with an agreement to, is it the USCMA?
I call it new NAFTA.
Yeah, new NAFTA. Dude, coming up with new NAFTA. And there are a lot of people pushing back on this, saying, you got to be kidding me. I mean, so on the one hand, you are impeaching him, but then you turn around and you give him his biggest legislative win since the tax cuts. But the Democrats are also arguing, look, we think this is good public policy. We're not going to hold this public policy right. hostage to politics. And this is a good counter for, you know, to accusations that we're a do nothing Congress, that we were focused on impeachment and we didn't do something that would be good for the country. So I don't know. Any of your take on this? It felt like a weird political moment.
I think there's merit to both sides of the argument. And I was witnessing this argument live earlier this morning between two very passionate people arguing different sides of this. On the one hand, yes, you're saying this president must be removed from office because he is so dangerous to the public. And then we'll work with him 1 hour later and announce we're doing so. That is incongruous. And that is something that, yes, I can imagine the president going out on the campaign trail and saying, I got a signature piece of legislation passed. I got the Democrats to cave in. Okay, maybe, but let me play devil's advocate. Donald Trump is not going to win election based on passing this deal. This is not what is going to either motivate the few swing voters left, nor is this going to get the turnout of his base ginned up. This is not going to be a massive campaign issue for him. Imagine the alternative scenario. If the Democrats held out longer for more provisions, or if they simply declined to act on this at all because they thought it was wrong, then you would have President Trump out on the campaign trail saying, see what I told you? Do you see what I told you about the deep state? Do you see what I told you about the establishment? Do you see what I told you about the swamp? They won't even sign something that is kind of similar to NAFTA in some ways, but they won't even sign something that they were involved in the negotiations on. They won't even go there. This is why you need to elect me. Honestly, I think that rallies the base to a higher turnout than saying, I got a legislative victory over a recalcitrant Congress. I don't think that's a high selling point for his reelection. So if you get to that point, if you realize that it might be a wash politically, if they didn't agree with this, the president would use that against them on the campaign trail. If they did agree with this, the president would use this against them on the campaign trail. Then you go back to what are they going to do to help not only moderates in the next House election, but some senators up for reelection, and perhaps even in the presidential election, depending on how the Democratic presidential candidate plays on this. You can make the case, you know, that argument that the president and his cronies were making about you can't impeach a president because we can't get any business done during impeachment.
Right.
Guess what? We impeach the president and we are still getting the people's business done.
We can walk
over to you, Senate, because we've passed 100 bills and you haven't acted on any of them. Who is it that's not getting the people's business done? I think it's a strong political argument in that way.
It may be. And Amy Walter, who is a very, very savvy observer, writes for the Cook Report, the national political editor, said she doesn't quite understand the framing that this new NAFTA is a victory only for Trump. Because if you're a freshman Democrat in a swing district, you explicitly ran on being able to be a check on Trump and, as you point out, and get stuff done for your district. So going, passing this does make it harder for Trump and the Republicans to argue the Democrats are just partisan hacks. Of course, they will anyway. They will have their narrative. And I'm completely completely agnostic on whether or not this New Deal is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm guessing that like most of these omnibus bills, it's a collection of all of those things. It's a collection of the good and the bad. By the way, even as we're speaking, I haven't had a chance to listen to it. Of course, you can't either. Apparently, Bill Barr is giving an interview to Pete Williams on MSNBC. Hmm. That I'm sure is going to be one of those. Another milestone in the willingness of the Attorney General to run interference for this particular president, apparently saying that there's nothing unusual about political candidates having contacts with political campaigns, having contacts with foreign governments. So up is down, black is white.
It is, but we have facts on the table now. We have the hearings. We have the articles of impeachment. Drawing all of the information in those hearings down to a very specific point. Are you going to accept, Mr. Representative or Madam Senator, are you going to accept that this behavior is okay? And if you do, then you have to put yourself out there and defend that to your voters in the future. But now they're articles. Now they're things
we can look at.
And there's one aspect of these articles that I need to point out, because it is something that is similar to the Clinton impeachment articles, the two of them that made it through the House. But it is different than the Nixon articles. And that is, when they talk about these high crimes and misdemeanors and what should happen as a result, the language in these articles of impeachment against Donald Trump says he should be removed from office and disqualified from future office. The Constitution allows both. And there's been...
Well, I thought it mandated both.
No, I thought if you were removed, you were okay.
So that's...
No,
that's
absolutely not.
All right.
In fact, the interpretation in the Senate... in most cases, has been that there needs to be a separate vote for that, that you convict the president and the president is automatically removed from office if convicted. At that moment, the president is no longer president. But in judicial hearings, they have held up the principle that there should be, more often than not, there should be a separate vote to disqualify the impeached and removed official from future office. Now, in the Clinton impeachment, they did include that phrase in the articles, both to remove the president and to disqualify the president. For Richard Nixon, they did not. Now, part of that is because he was in his second term as president. The 25th Amendment was in operation. Richard Nixon could not legally run for a third term as president. But of course, he could have run for Congress and he could have gotten elected if in the right district. But they did not include that in the articles of impeachment against him. For Donald Trump, they explicitly did. And I think that does relate back to the fact that this is the first term president who is almost certain to have articles of impeachment voted against him and to be impeached and therefore to go before a vote of removal. As a first term president under the terms of the 25th Amendment, he can certainly run for another term. And so they put in there the issue of disqualification from future office.
Yesterday's hearing made it pretty clear once again that likely there'll be no Republicans that will vote in favor of this. A lot of hopes had been resting on Will Hurd, who is retiring and a pretty good guy, but he's figured out a way to rationalize not voting in favor of this. Although I would urge people to go to the Bulwark website to read Jonathan Last's outstanding piece, sort of deconstructing Will Hurd's logic and his reasoning and pointing out that, okay, if you take his concerns seriously, how do you vote against the article of obstruction of Congress, which is really not a factual question at all. I guess, how concerned are you, though, that this will go to the Senate, they will do a quickie trial, the president will claim exoneration, and that, in fact, at the end of the day, it will supercharge the president's sense that there are no checks and balances on him, that he can get away with anything. So
it's
that,
certainly possible.
Yeah.
And he can't deny that logic. But I'm trying to imagine any other scenario in which the president would not claim the same and also supercharge. That is, when the House has an impeachment inquiry and you have these witnesses come forward saying these things, non-political mm-hmm. people saying how outrageous this is. If they decided not to draft articles of impeachment, or if the House were to decide not to vote for impeachment, the president will go out and claim exoneration and try to rally the base with it, just the way he would with a Senate trial. So to me, it's almost a wash. What you're left with is, if the effect is going to be largely the same on how Donald Trump reacts, which I would argue is not the first criterion you should use for whether to bring articles of impeachment. It should be whether impeachable acts were committed and whether an unfit president needs to be removed from office. But if you're going to go to what is most likely to either inflame the electorate for Donald Trump or not, you know what? I'm not sure that backing off from articles of impeachment is the stronger move. I think putting it to the Senate, forcing people to go into a vote, and then saying to the American people, this president was impeached for his acts. Hopefully, it's even a bipartisan vote in the Senate. If one senator decides from the Republican side, if one senator decides to go along with one article of impeachment, then it is a bipartisan vote in the Senate that the president should be removed from office. Even if it does not result in the removal, you can say that it was a bipartisan vote. That alone is a strong rebuke of the president, and both stands up well in posterity, but also helps make the case for people on the trail that they did what they could in the current system to show that this was unacceptable behavior. Now it's up to the voters.
I think that's a compelling argument, because you could certainly argue that the president's increasingly outrageous behavior has been a product of the fact that he has been able to get away with so much, that not just in the context of impeachment, but in the lack of any sort of congressional oversight or accountability, that we've seen the trajectory of this presidency, and that that the failure to even begin impeachment would not necessarily, you know, have any restraining, would certainly not be restraining in any way on this president's willingness to violate norms or to be utterly shameless. So,
as we've talked about, and as authors have written in the Bulwark in many, many cases in the last few years, what have people gained by saying, you know, the president's going to attack me, so I need to go along to get along? It actually doesn't work well. Whatever you're trying to protect by doing that, the road is littered with previous officials who worked with the Trump administration, whose reputations are now in tatters, and they did not protect the things that they wanted to protect. So what is the real value? Saying, well, we don't want to get the president angry, so, you know, he's probably going to be acquitted in the Senate, so let's not call out this behavior for what it is and use the one constitutional process we have for pointing out that it is unfit, that it is a violation of the oath, that it is inconsistent with the presidency. Let's just not do that because, you know, it might not work. That would be an abdication of responsibility.
And of course, even as we are taping this, the president is meeting with Russian foreign minister at the White House. You remember the last time that happened?
You can't write this stuff.
Yeah, less than 24 hours after he fired Comey and he revealed highly classified information. And I'm guessing that they're going to come out and they're going to, you know, say that they had this very, very strong conversation about election interference, which nobody will take seriously.
Oh, I'm not sure they're even going to bother, Charlie. I think that the fig leaf is off. They're not going to bring up that the meeting was principally about adoption. They're not going
to
bring out that
the
Trump chastised them for election interference. The only election interference I expect, if they talk about this at all, I understand the Russian press may have access, but the U.S. press does not. If they talk about it at all, it'll probably be the president asking the Russians for assistance and finding out how the Ukrainians interfered in the election, which is total garbage.
You know, I feel a little bit guilty, the fact that we don't have enough time or bandwidth now to talk about this other story that's been unfolding in the last couple of days, these mm-hmm. Afghanistan war papers.
Yeah.
I sat down and was reading through some of them last night, very much the sort of the Afghan war version of the Pentagon papers, an extraordinary cache of material that just raises all sorts of doubts about that war. And so we'll have to have you back to talk about that when everybody's absorbed it. But unfortunately, we're in a moment now where everything is about impeachment and all of this. But talk about a disillusioning experience reading mm-hmm. through all of this, and again, this is not cherry picked by the Washington Post. This is these were government in interviews, you know, hundreds of them, thousands of hours with the people who were on the ground, who were the decision makers, who were close to it, and so their testimony is incredibly compelling about all of the mistakes, dysfunction, and misinformation about this war in Afghanistan. And so, again, on Earth 2.0, this would be the consuming issue. And
it's
now
a great reminder.
It's just a sideshow.
It's a great reminder that, yes, we are focused on impeachment. I happen to focus on that. But guess what? There are a lot of wonderful people, both in the United States government, but also analysts outside of government, who are looking at issues like the rise of China, who are looking at issues like 5G and national security, who are looking at issues like nuclear security, and even issues like the seemingly endless war in Afghanistan. There are people working on this. There are people trying to make progress. It's hard when the public sphere is blocked out by all of this constitutional and political talk. But all of that part of government is still operating, is still churning, is still trying to come up with some solutions. And if we can learn from the past, if we can learn mm-hmm. from going on 20 years of involvement in that conflict, where were mistakes made? How can we improve upon those? Is there any way to overcome some of the things that have happened? We need to be doing that. And I'm assured people are doing that who are focused on that topic. The fact that it's not a larger public debate is actually quite sad given the loss of life, not to mention expenses. I'm talking about the loss of life in Afghanistan for the goals that the United States government under successive administrations has set. If we're going to get one thing right, it really needs to be that, and yeah. we're just not giving it the public attention that it deserves.
No, this is a great point. And the fact that you did have, you know, so many of these officials who are willing to be so honest and so candid. And also a reminder that facts matter, truth matters, credibility matters, and that there's a huge price if you squander that credibility. David Priest, thank you so much for coming in to our studios today and spending so much time with us. Appreciate it.
You bet.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today was brought to you by our friends from Quip. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.